Now we have David Grimm, the editor for our daily news site. He's here this week to talk about some recent online stories. I'm Sarah Crespi. First up, we have a story on powerful fish spit. Archer fish hunt by spitting streams of water at insects above the water, and then they grab their suddenly submerged targets when they fall in. So, Dave, my understanding is that researchers had to train these fish for a year in the laboratory to understand and study them. What exactly were they trying to do with this training?
Well, these fish have this pretty remarkable ability. You can actually see a slow motion video of a fish spitting an insect out of the air on the site. But we already know a few things that are remarkable about this ability. First of all, you know, trying to spit at something when you're under the water and they're above the water, you have to correct for a lot of visual distortions. There's got to be a lot of power in that spit. And the researchers in this study really wanted to figure out how the fish are so accurate. I mean, they're spitting often at fairly large distances, and they've got to keep that stream very concentrated, because if it breaks up in midair, it's not going to have the power to knock an insect off a branch or what have you.
Right. They're spitting like 2 meters?
Yes, as far as 2 meters away. And the fish is only 25 centimeters long.
So they are training them to spit so then they could analyze what exactly they were doing when they spit?
They spent a year training these fish. They gathered some fish from Thailand, some of these archer fish, and they spent a year training them not to spit because they already knew how to spit, but training them to hit specific targets that were about 20 to 60 centimeters in height from precise locations. And while they were doing that, the researchers were taking high-speed videos of the fish to really figure out how they achieve such accurate aim.
And when they reviewed the tapes, what did they find out about the fish's aim?
Well, the fish have a lot of adaptations to both make this stream more powerful, but also to keep it very accurate. It's sort of like a sharpshooter. And actually, they say the mechanism isn't that dissimilar from the mechanism of the mammalian penis in the fact that it's able to take the stream and keep it very focused and concentrated over large distances.
So there's a lot of other stuff going on here, too. We're talking about the shape of the mouth and also how far open they hold their mouth when they're shooting for these bugs. But now that we know this, how can this new understanding be applied beyond hunting bugs?
Well, one of the interesting things is that this is such a complicated ability that these fish have that some researchers actually compare it to tool use. It's effectively the same as humans throwing spears at prey. These fish have learned how to turn water into a weapon. And why that's interesting is because it's thought that our ability to use tools really helped increase our brain size, led to a lot more complex cognition, which really was obviously very important for the evolution of our species. And the question is, if this is indeed tool use by these archer fish, are they undergoing a similar cognitive revolution?
Next up, we have a story on the relationship between art and life. Ancient Egyptian art is rich with depictions of the local animals of the time: zebra, giraffes, even ostriches. As you may have noticed, not all of these animals that are in the art are still around. Now, researchers are using this discrepancy to take a closer look at extinctions. Dave, what time period is this work focused on?
We're talking about going back up to 6,000 years. This is a time well before the pyramids. We're talking about etchings on prehistoric rock. Later on, we do see the drawings, the paintings on the insides of tombs, which a lot of people are familiar with, and we actually have a picture of that on the site. Even carvings, decorative carvings on things like knife handles. All of these tend to contain depictions of animals, and what the researchers really want to see is how do these animals change over time, not just the type of animals that are represented, but even the number of animals.
And when they look back at animal loss as represented in these artifacts, what kinds of patterns were they able to see?
Well, one of the big things that they saw was when you had these dramatic shifts in climate and land use, you also saw these dramatic shifts in the number of predators relative to the number of prey, which you would kind of expect when you have things like sudden dryings of the Nile Valley or you have these big population booms. That's going to have an impact on the animals. But the researchers were especially interested in how, in these predator-prey relationships, how stable are these ecosystems? And if you start to lose predators or if you start to lose prey species, what impact does that have on the entire ecosystem? And they found that the most ancient and the most species-rich ecosystems were the most resilient, but that over time, these networks become less and less stable as they start to lose members. You have less prey available for predators, or you have fewer predators to control the prey, and things kind of degrade over time, where we have this situation now where there's only 8 large mammal species remaining in Egypt, up from speculated about 37 in ancient times.
That's all based on modeling and also the artwork. This is my nitpicky question. Isn't it possible some of the art from back then was fanciful? The animals were there, but a long time before, never there, but actually painted for artistic reasons.
Right. And that's what some experts say, is that just because an animal appears in Egyptian art doesn't necessarily mean that animal was actually there. It could have been symbolic. It could have been historical. The artist is just trying to remember an animal that perhaps used to exist and depicting it. So we have to be a little bit careful about making this one-to-one comparison between seeing animals in art and whether they are actually there in real life.
Lastly, we have a story on the reliability of clinical trials. Clinical trials are the last step before a drug or treatment reaches patients. These types of experiments are required to prove that a drug, for example, is effective and does not have extreme side effects. But a recent look at reanalysis studies suggests clinical trials are not always accurately reported. Okay, Dave, what's a reanalysis study?
Well, a reanalysis study is sort of what it sounds like. It's a new group of researchers, ideally, going back and looking at an older study and taking a look at the raw data in that study and maybe applying some more recent or more accurate statistical techniques to analyze that data and try to see if they come to the same conclusions that the original authors did.
And in this study of studies of studies, the researchers look through Medline, which is a huge database of medical and biological research for these types of studies. What kinds of results did they see when they looked at the reanalysis?
Well, they're looking at clinical trials. These are the type of trials and these are the type of studies that tend to lead to recommendations, not just about the types of drugs that should be used or shouldn't be used or the dosages, but even things like surgeries and other therapies. They found about 3,000 trials, and they found that 37 of these had been reanalyzed by other groups.
And when you say 37 have been reanalyzed, it means those are the published reports of reanalysis.
That's right.
And so there's a catch here. There are actually problems that the reanalysis studies found with the original analysis. What kind of errors were they finding?
Well, for example, there was a study that was done on methotrexate, which has been used to treat something called systemic sclerosis, which is an autoimmune disease. Now, the original study in 2001 found that the drug was really not any more effective than the placebo, so the authors didn't recommend using it for this particular condition. However, researchers reanalyzed the paper 8 years later. They used a more accurate type of analysis, statistical analysis, and this time they found that the drug was actually more effective than placebo, so much more so that they actually recommended this drug being used for these sclerosis patients.
That's a positive result, right? It actually found, oh, this was an effective treatment. There's also some things that are going in the opposite direction.
Well, right. For example, a therapy called sclerotherapy, in which a drug is injected to treat dilated veins in the esophagus. And the original study, which was conducted in 1984, actually found that it was effective. But a 2001 study found that it was not effective, that the treatment did not reduce mortality. So the researchers found examples of both cases. And as a whole, they found that 13 of these 37 reanalysis studies actually came to conclusions different from those of what the original team concluded.
These 37 studies that they looked at could be somewhat of a biased sample, though, because basically to get published, you have to have something interesting to say. It's kind of a bias in the literature in general. So if they didn't contradict the original findings, they might not actually get published. Is there any way to know how common this is in general with data from clinical trials?
Well, the problem is a lot of the data from clinical trials, especially if it's conducted or sponsored by pharmaceutical companies, tends to not make it into the scientific literature. So there's just reams and reams of data out there that are not being analyzed, that are not being published. And it's really hard to tell how many of these studies are actually being accurately reported without having access to that original data.
A lot of problems are coming up because there's secrecy surrounding raw clinical data. Is there anything being done to address this problem?
Yeah, there's been a lot of outcry to release more clinical data. There's something called the All Trials Campaign, which is a global effort to push for open clinical research, with thousands of researchers and organizations pledging to share all of their clinical data. It seems like people realize that this is a problem that needs to be addressed.
Okay, so what else is on the site this week, Dave?
Well, Sarah, we've got a story about how your microbiome, these are all the bacteria that live on you and in you, may influence the efficacy of certain vaccines. Also a story about researchers tracking morality by our smartphone use. for Science Insider, our policy blog, we've got a story on the impact that Scottish independence, if it happens, will have on science. Also, two new studies have come out that have both good news and bad news for the fate of the U.S.'s bird populations. So be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Sarah.
David Grimm is the editor for our online daily news site. He'll be out next week, but back the following. I'm Sarah Crespi. You can check out the latest news and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org. This segment is part of the Science Podcast. You can hear the whole show on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and the Science website, www.sciencemag.org. This segment is part of the Science Podcast. You can hear the whole show on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and the Science website, www.sciencemag.org.